If you think about the analogy, if you're a jockey, the offer is your horse. So I'm not a very good jockey. I'm not a great salesperson. But if you give me a good horse, I'll do okay. And the offer is the horse. So make a good offer and you'll close a lot of business.
Hey, podcast listener, even if you are alone in your entrepreneurial journey, know that today, right now in your earbuds, you are joined by thousands of entrepreneurs from all around the globe seeking to grow better, more profitable, location-independent businesses. If you'd like to learn more about what we do and download our entire back catalog, check out tropicalmba.com.
Happy Thursday morning, everybody. Welcome back to the Tropical MBA podcast. Today, we're going to talk about something I like to call the $1 million question. Depending on which research paper you read, only 4% of businesses get to $1 million. But the data suggests that all our work is still ahead of us if we want to grow that business on to $10 million. Our chances of actually getting to $10 million in revenue from that original business are significantly decreased. I've got research here that suggests less than 1% of all businesses get to $10 million. So we've worked hard for years. We've adjusted our mindset. We've got some key hires. We've found some repeatable sources of customers. We get to $1 million and dang, all of our work is still ahead of us. I brought in today's guest who's recently passed the $100,000 a month mark to talk through this issue and a bunch of other things. There's a lot of common ways out there that I see founders deal with this $1 million question. One is just to sell the business. Just to bail. It's a very, very common one. Or to bail emotionally and take your foot off the gas. I see people put an operator in place, a CEO or a COO or a general manager. In fact, something today's guest has done, we're going to talk through that. And then finally, there's this option to focus and push through. I outline this challenge because it's something I'm really, really interested in. Y'all know we run a recruiting agency called Remote First Recruiting. We also help founders hire SDRs as well as a bunch of other hires. And Andrew's doing the same thing. Today's guest, he runs a company that does over $100,000 a month. It's a productized service. It's called Growth Era. So we're going to dig into his decision-making around the $1 million question and see if it might shed some light on our journeys. There's a bunch of other interesting things that Andrew's going to touch on here. The first being the economics of cold outreach. How much annual contract value or lifetime value of a customer do you need to capitalize on SDRs and cold outreach campaigns in general? We're also going to talk about how to have business ideas. I think a really interesting way to generate business ideas is to figure out if you can find an edge in a demand channel. Obviously, cold email outreach is a demand channel. So is meeting people at conferences, your personal network, YouTube, Twitter, SEO. And of course, there's countless others, but I think really digging down into specific channels and thinking through the economics of those channels and how you can be competitive is a great way to develop business ideas. Speaking of business ideas, Andrew shares an opinion that I have, which is he's focused on servicing people, not educating people when he's generating these ideas. And you can see how that leads to the types of businesses he's starting. We're also going to touch on when your company is ready to bring in the quote adults, something he's recently done. He's also going to toss a big pinch of salt at us when considering that permanent travel lifestyle, something that today's guest has a ton of experience about. So that's it. I really enjoyed this conversation with Andrew. You can check out everything he's up to in the show notes today. Let's roll the conversation.
My name is Andrew Jacoby, and I'm an entrepreneur and artist. So I do podcasts, music, writing, and create businesses. Those are the creative endeavors.
I want to kind of anchor the audience into your core business, or I want to talk about Growth Era. Could you let us know what it does, why it started? Bring us into this world.
Yep. So Growth Era started as a company called Next Sales, but actually what I was doing before when I first left the United States in 2010. Well, I first left in 2008, went 2 years and then came back. But that whole time I was doing SDR work myself, which basically means that I was doing outbound sales. So my history in sales was I started out in the car business, selling cars out in San Francisco when it was clear that my musician dreams were like foundering and I wasn't able to make a living.
I can relate to that.
Yeah, I was living on a couch, and this like Andrew follows his muse thing was following my muse into, let's say, some drug and alcohol habits, which weren't super great, and then some financial realities, which were also less than ideal. So I decided that I wasn't going to go fully into that, and I probably would get a job, but nobody would hire me because I studied literature and political philosophy. So I got a job called Accelerate Your Income. I moved out to San Francisco to follow a girl, as people will do. Also, there was a church for John Coltrane out there, believe it or not. And I was really into John Coltrane at the time. So I went out there, couldn't get a job.
Somehow makes total sense to me.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I found a job. The ad in the paper was Accelerate Your Income. And I was like, I don't have any income. So any acceleration will be positive at this point. So I went out and it was selling cars. And all I had to do was pass a piss test. And I went and bought a suit at like Salvation Army or something. And I found out that I got the job. And I realized that everybody got the job who could fog up a mirror, which is great because I could fog up a mirror. So I got that job. And that was my first sales gig. And it turns out I was really good at it. I had this East Coast mentality and they were all these mellow West Coast guys. So I was just hustling and they didn't hustle that much. And I turned out really good at it. But anyway, that was a different kind of sales model. That's where like the ads would go out in the paper and then people would come back in with these ads and say like, hey, I want the Civic for $100 a month. And it's like, oh, we sold that one, but we have this other one here that's a little bit more expensive. Anyway, so that was the car business. That was the basic business model.
So it was a bait and switch model.
Well, that's the basic car business. It's the bait and switch model. And then I didn't feel good about it because you make money financing poor people, which is with super high APRs. And I didn't really like that model. And a friend of mine called me up. This was 1998. So first .com boom. And he's like, yo, what are you doing? I'm like, I don't know. I'm selling cars. I'm like, what are you doing? Where'd you go since high school? Well, I don't know. Long story. I met this girl. We're going to get married. Okay. Why are you doing that? He's like, oh, you know, it's a thing. I was like, okay, cool. So he got married. He's like, what are you working? I'm saying, I'm working selling cars. He's like, well, I'm selling computers because there's this like thing coming around called the internet and you should probably get involved in that and stop selling cars. I'm like, okay. So that was a different sales model. That was going outbound. So you sat in a cubicle, they gave you a yellow pages and you started dialing, smiling and dialing. And so that's what we were doing. We were selling to, my territory was Sacramento for the government and then San Francisco.
Were you scared to do that? That fear of interrupting people's days? And
I was super competitive. I grew up as an athlete. And so that was just what was necessary to win. And my buddy was also an athlete. So we were super competitive with one another and I didn't want him to beat me. And so if I was going to beat him, I had to make cold calls, more cold calls than him. And so I wanted to do that at that time. That was super compelling reasoning for me. And so that's what I did. I just made a lot of cold calls. Was it painful? Yes. And then at some point, I decided I didn't really love the commute thing. I didn't like the suit and tie thing. I didn't like traffic in the morning, traffic at night thing. And I'm like, hey, look, if mostly what I'm doing, the big innovation here is that I can talk to a lot of people on the phone, which is different than the car business. And so what I decided to do, I was like, look, I'm just going to work independent contractor from home. Because if all I'm doing is on the phone. And then the next logical step was, why don't I just do that abroad? Because if I'm in Philadelphia or in San Francisco, it costs me a lot of money to live. And I could do that better in wherever, Thailand or what have you. And I'd have to work less and I could make money. So I'm also a musician and I like to play music. So I wanted to maximize that. And so I started doing it and it worked. And I could be abroad for a long period of time and pay for my life given the sales work. And then I started trying to find other people to do it because I thought it was a pretty cool idea. And I was super unsuccessful for a while because most people are like, let's make cold calls. As you said, that's scary. It's painful. And so I couldn't find anybody. And then time went by. I kind of got out of it. I got into copywriting and things like that. Then I got into actually playing music on the streets. But ultimately what happened was that I kept getting pulled back into this sales thing because it was consistent income. And finally, I found somebody on Upwork from Macedonia. And I was like, look, man, I hired him for some outbound calling thing that I had going on. And I hired him and he turned out to be really good. And he was really motivated. He didn't turn his nose up at it. You know, he had a weird accent, but so what? And he was good and he was hungry and I could teach him. And then I was living in Vienna at the time. And I was like, well, I had to leave Vienna because, you know, a visa problem. And Macedonia is outside of the Schengen zone. So I said, hey, man, are there other people like you in wherever the heck Macedonia is? And he said, yeah. So I was like, all right, man, I'll be there. Was there an Airbnb around? Cool, let's do it. So I rolled over to Macedonia and we built a business. Him and I, he's my co-founder I found on Upwork. And now we built the business. We had one client. He paid us $500 the first month. And then he fired us. So we had zero clients the next month. And now, you know, it's a seven-figure business. And we have 62 people that do outbound appointment setting. We have clients that do multi-billion dollars in a year and clients that do a couple million dollars in a year. Now we're expanding the product offering to various other things, but it was built on outbound. It was built on appointment setting. So that's kind of the story.
That's crazy. What is an SDR?
A sales development representative. Last night I went out to dinner with my dad and, you know, we looked at a menu and we saw, hey, a burger sounds good. Let's buy the burger. Picture burger, point, picture burger, buy burger, eat burger. Easy, right? $12, $15, whatever. When you're buying a $500,000 consulting project, the sales process is not that simple. There's lots of people involved. There's multiple meetings. There's multiple what they call stakeholders. So you got to get somebody on the phone in order to start that whole process. And so the sales development representative's job is to find somebody who is willing to even have a conversation. So what does that look like? I'll give you my pitch for, we were selling waste consulting. So it was like, hey, Dan, my name is Andrew Jacoby. I'm calling from Waste Reduction Consultants. We help large apartment owners and managers reduce their waste hauling expenses. We average a 30% reduction in those expenses and we do it all on a pay for performance basis. So if there are no savings, there are no fees. Interested? And that would be like the pitch. Right. So like that's what I was doing going outbound because this was a big consultancy. And I would go pitch that to every apartment owner guy who owned 2000 or more apartments in the country. And I would just repeat that pitch over and over and over again. And most people would hang up at me, tell me to go F myself, whatever. But every once in a while, somebody would say, hey, you know what? That sounds interesting, man. You know, I'm struggling with these expense items. These waste haulers are jacking me around. And if you can help me and it's not going to cost me anything, sure, send me over your brochure, send me an email. And then I'd say, okay, send the email. And then you try to set the meeting and that's it. And then the executive takes over.
What sorts of businesses get the most value from SDRs and why?
That's a great question. There's a couple of things that you need to have in order to make this work. Number one, the more money you make lifetime value is the better. We tell people if you're not making at least 20K, lifetime value, it's hard to have a human being going outbound. It's the financial algorithm. Your first input is how much money are you paying the rep? The second input financially is how much are the meetings turning into? So if you pay the rep, let's say $1,000 in a month, just use simple math, and they develop 4 meetings, that means your cost per meeting is $250. So the question then is, the next piece of the financial algorithm is how many meetings do you need on average to close the deal? If you need 5, then you have your cost per sale. And if you need 10, sometimes you need 20. I had some like accounting guy who couldn't sell his way out of a paper bag. The dude needed 50 meetings to close a deal. And so his cost per deal was really expensive. However, you know, he made hundreds of thousands of dollars when he closed the deal. So it worked. So that's number one. Number two, you need enough people to call. So if you're like Peter Thiel and you're working at, what's his company? Palantir. He can sell to the DOD and the NSA. You got to go press the flesh with those guys. You got to go to conferences. That's not a cold calling type of operation. You only have 2 customers that you can sell to in the world. Somebody else, if you're a nationwide consultant for taxes, you know, whatever, that's anybody. So it's great because there's a lot of people to call because this is more or less a volume business and you don't want to piss people off. So if you're calling people too much, you want to be professional and persistent, but you don't want to overdo it. And so if your market's too small, you're going to overdo it. And the third piece is you have to be able to close business because it's different than an inbound. If your mommy knows her buddy and your mommy introduces her buddy to you, you're going to have a high close rate with your mommy's buddies, right? So you have to be prepared for a more difficult close. And so the way to make that work is all about front-end offer. Remember the pitch I gave you before was that 30% average savings, no harm, no foul. We don't charge you anything unless we save you money. That's a good front-end offer. It's a low-risk offer. So what you want to do is find a way to make your offer as low-risk as possible. If you think about the analogy, the offer, if you're a jockey, the offer is your horse. So I'm not a very good jockey. I'm not a great salesperson. But if you give me a good horse, I'll do okay. and the offer is the horse. So make a good offer and you'll close a lot of business.
What do the best-in-class offers share in common? How do your clients that are the top-performing clients construct them?
I would say the best-in-class offer, number one, if you have a good brand, that's really helpful. The multi-billion dollar company we work with, they get their foot in the door a lot because of who they are. If you don't have that, which most people don't, the next thing is a best-in-class offer. The way I like to think about it personally is, what is the minimum viable amount of work or of your product that you could give to somebody that they would get value? And then try to construct an offer around that that reverses the risk. I'm building a new company. I don't work in Growthera anymore. I don't have an operational role. I'm only on the board. And our staffing offer is, we offer 10 hours of free labor. So that's our first offer to people. So our outbound efforts in our sales development units are, can I give you 10 hours of free labor? Is that possible? Will you allow me to do that? And you'd be surprised. Like, most people are like, no.
I love the jockey analogy, because I think one of the challenges people have with hiring SDRs is that they say, well, I've been the jockey, because a lot of our customers, a lot of our listeners, you know, have sub $5 million businesses. Yep. They're the jockey. And so now I need a better horse to hand off to a lesser skilled jockey.
Right.
I'm doing the economic breakdown now. How much is going to cost me per meeting, my close rate? I've got that cost. How does that compare with the cost of then the free work that my offer includes?
That's a cost of doing business. So it's basically, I consider that advertising cost. If you offer gift, when these people, you get these gift cards, they have a financial model that not everybody's going to use the gift card. So every gift card isn't really a $50 gift card. It's really less than that, because not everybody's going to use it. So it's the same thing if you're offering free trials to people. Not everybody is going to convert into a client.
Have you ever seen an SDR strategy work well for a company with less than a $20,000 LTV?
Yeah, it can work. It's just that you have to be much tighter on the numbers, and you have to have a really attractive offer. You can move that lever. If your offer is super attractive and you're getting a lot of meetings.
How have you seen that done?
Well, it's like product market fit. So for example, for a while right now, it was really easy for a period. It was really easy. These ERC credits, everybody's been spammed ERC credits, right? It's like free money from the government, and it's going away tomorrow. It's going away in a year. And you could get like 20 grand per employee. I forget what it was. That was a really an easy offer for a period of time. It was really hot because everyone's like, free money from the government. I hate the government. Give me all the free money I can get from the government. And it's going away. It has a lot of elements of a good offer. So for that particular thing, even if they had a small LTV, that could have worked. Now, they happen to have a big LTV, so it worked. Like, a lot of people make a lot of money in that. But even if that particular thing had a small LTV, they could make it work because their offer is super strong. So that would work. And their close would be easy, because it's like, hey, man, you don't want to do this. We're going to do it for you. We're experts. Give us your taxes and we'll get you your money.
Can you describe for me your business model and how it compares to bringing an SDR in-house?
Yep.
In Latin America versus Growthera is a managed service, as I understand it, where I'm paying you and you're taking a margin on each person you have in-house.
There's no right or wrong way to do it. Some people view the idea of bringing it in-house as easier and better over the long term. You know, I'm agnostic about that. For some people, it's great because you can just give us who your market is, you can give us who your ideal client is, and you can tell us what your offer is, and we can take that raw material and get you meetings. And that's great for some of our clients. But in order to do that, you're going to pay our margin. So could you do that cheaper and figure out how to do that on your own? Yeah, you could. And would that be better? Maybe, maybe not. Depends on what you want to accomplish. But what we do, it's a painful role because it's emotionally difficult. Typically, it's an entry-level position. So people churn out a lot of the role in general. So you might hire three people, two of them might churn out in 60 days. So you spent all that time training them. And so a lot of clients that come to us, they don't want to deal with that. They just want the meeting output. And they're happy to pay maybe even a premium to have us do it for them.
You mentioned you didn't resonate with the SaaS model personally. What would you say are the positives and negatives of your business model? What are the great things about it? And what are the things that you guys are challenged with?
Well, we're scaling with people. So if you look at our revenue compared to our people, we have 62 people, 62 employees. So If we had a SaaS company with the same amount of revenue, that would be different. I liked the agency model. It's a productized service, right? We just do the same thing for everybody, although now we're offering different services. But for the first 5 years, while I was CEO, when I started it, it was just one offering. And we got pretty good at doing it. We got pretty good at scaling it. I would say you have to be good operationally to run this kind of model. So that's a downside if that's not your personality and it's not mine, which is why somebody else is running the company, not me.
What does it mean for you to be good operationally?
I'm more of a creative, crazy, chaotic. I'm like a pirate. I need to be on a pirate ship. While it's a pirate ship, it's great. I'm an awesome pirate ship leader. But once you need a sea captain and it turns into spreadsheets and HR and taxes and finance, my eyes glaze over and I just want to break stuff and try new stuff. And so that becomes a net negative to a business over time because it doesn't need that chaos. It ultimately needs somebody who can just tweak the knobs. And I brought in our CEO as an amazing operator. He's exited two businesses, similar kinds of businesses, and he's an amazing operator. And when I brought him in, I was like, oh, so that's how you do this. I have no idea. He's like running EOS. I didn't know what EOS is, like traction or something where you have different meetings. Yep. And there's like, I don't know any of that, man. I'm like, look, dude, you just go make this work. I don't know how you make it work. Go do it. I got to go sell something to somebody. We got to send some email. You know, I'm like a cook with all the spaghetti on the walls and whatever. So that's what I'm good at. And so I just stay in my lane. I just build the business to a certain point and then I try to find someone else to run it. Because I can't. So I think the danger of the business model is if you're scaling that business with people, you need to have a certain operational skill level. You don't need much technical skill level, but you need operational skill level. So if you don't have that, it might not be a great model.
How do you think about your labor costs relative to your billing? How did you think about in the early days and now capacity versus selling?
In my early days, I didn't care. I was interested in, you're a golfer, Dan. I was interested in driving distance. I wanted to hit $1 million in top line revenue. That's all I cared about. Everything else be damned. And I was just like, what are we charging these people? Okay, we'll double it. Let's go. That was like the sophistication of my thinking. And you look it up in the dictionary, it's called idiocy. So I didn't know what I was doing. And I just, but I did know how to sell people stuff. So I just kept selling it at the wrong price. So my unit economics were all jacked up and messed up. And luckily our CEO, which interestingly, our CEO was my client when I was doing outbound. He ended up selling his business, becoming a coach. He was our coach. And then he came in and became our CEO because he wanted to actually get back in the saddle. And he didn't want to start from zero. So he came in and was our coach. And he came in and built a sophisticated adult level. And so our prices, when we started out, I was charging $800 for like a rep. Now, you know, we charge $4,800. It's different because we now understand our business model and our finances.
Do you have any sense for what makes a good opportunity versus a not good one?
First of all, you have to know what you're doing in the thing. Like I knew, I already had experience in it. And everything that I had tried outside my experience, like what Warren Buffett would call your circle of competence, if you're outside of your circle of competence, beware. You're not as smart or as good as you think you are. Figure out what you already know how to do and then build a business around that. I like things that recur. I like things that everybody needs leads forever. So it's not like you get some leads or sales meetings this month and you're like, thanks, Dan, or thanks, Andrew. I got all the sales meetings I need. You need sales meetings forever as long as you want. So I like services that recur like that. You can do SEO, PPC, graphic design, anything. It can be done successfully as long as there's enough market and LTV and you build your own little special sauce, whatever that is. For us, it was, I had experience. I'm good at copywriting and I had this labor pool in Eastern Europe in the Balkans that was good for less.
I think it's interesting because, you know, you're making a really good living, building incredible businesses, but they're not new. And I think some people struggle with that. They think that there needs to be something new. There's a lot of those and they've been around for a long time. So why would you think there's space for you?
There's a great guy online on Twitter, Nick Huber. He's got this podcast called The Sweaty Startup. And his whole thing is, there's a lot of money to be made in just average businesses, your landscapers or your pool cleaners and stuff that you know people pay for. When I started my entrepreneurial career, I did in 1999, when I left selling, I went and a buddy of mine raised money to do a startup with customized apparel online using the internet, which is a great idea, by the way. It just wasn't a great idea in 1999 and we lost a bunch of money doing it. And I just got cured of finding the new. Because it's very expensive to educate a market. It's hard enough to serve a market, to sell a market. it's really difficult and really expensive to educate them. And I don't want to be in that business. I want to be in the business of serving people, not educating them.
How do you figure out your pricing for the new assistant business?
What I noticed in the last business is that pricing is based on confidence level. And if I don't know that I'm that good, I typically tend to price too low. But I feel comfortable doing that because I don't feel like I can add that much value yet to the marketplace because I'm new in the business. And that naturally grows over time as my confidence grows. So I noticed that my confidence and my pricing track together because I just feel more comfortable charging more when I know more of what I'm doing. If I'm just jumping in and I don't know what I'm doing, I feel bad charging more money for what I'm doing. So I feel better about what I'm doing when I get better at it, and then I charge more money. That's the natural progression for me.
When you start to get a momentum with the business, like Growth Era, it's like, do I evolve as that CEO and become a great operator, or do I stick to what I'm good at? And you've seemed to have a lot of confidence around the route that you've chosen as the pirate. How do you know when a company is ready for adults? How do you get them, and how do you compensate them?
You know through pain. I learn everything through suffering. It's like Edmund Burke has this great line, experience is the school of mankind, for he will learn at no other. So you can't tell me your experiences because I won't learn from you. I will learn from me getting punched in the face. Because as I said before in Next Sales, which was Growth Era now, but before Next Sales, I learned that all I cared about was hitting that $1 million run rate and nothing else mattered to me. And then I did that and I made a huge mess. I caused a lot of pain for myself because I didn't know what I was doing and I grew the thing out of control. So that was really painful. And then I brought in adults to help and they really helped and I started to learn. Now, Bryce is our CEO and I happen to know him because I was his SDR a long time ago. This new company, we have a private equity company that was a client of ours before and they wanted to buy some of Next Sales because they saw the growth and they wanted to invest and they were going to put an operator in. I just didn't know them. So I wanted, it was my baby. And I wanted somebody who I knew. And I knew I had known Bryce for 9 years. And I knew he was a killer. And we were really lucky to get him. So I was on the phone with the private equity guys last week. And I'm like, I've proven myself as a proven quantity in terms of being able to grow businesses and not being able to run them. So help me. Come on in as an investor. Buy a piece of this so that I can go start the next one and then bring you in for that. Because that's their business, is buying pieces of businesses and then putting operators in and getting the founders out. So that's my model. Whether that will work or not in the future, we'll have to see. But that's the way I want to do it because, and then to answer your question about when, the sooner, the better, in my view. But I would say if you're somebody that you don't feel like you're a good operator, but you want to grow a business, the sooner you could get out, the better, and then build relationships with other people to try to find somebody that you could trust to run it. There's lots of ways to do it. That's the way I did it.
As an agency owner, one of the things you get to do is have a front row seat to a lot of businesses out there and see how they operate. What's your opinion about businesses that are super high quality versus more middling businesses? How are they separating themselves? Is it luck or is there some trend that you see that highly profitable, successful growing businesses have?
I think businesses are all people. So it's really the quality, the inputs of business. It's not technology, it's human beings. So the quality of the human beings. And I would say, and this sounds going to sound a little bit weird, but the moral fiber of the human beings that are working in the business, are they honest? Do they tell the truth? Do they have integrity? Do they work hard? Do they have an attitude of service and of love towards others? The people that really embody that and live that, we'll find a business idea where they can do that. Like the Amish, Dan, where people live out where you are, they're famous for having super successful businesses. Even yeah. though they have like eighth grade educations and they don't use technology. And yet their businesses fail at a much lower rate. Why? Because they work hard, they're honest, people trust them. And they're the kind of people that deserve that trust. So it's like Charlie Munger would say, it's like, if you want a good wife, how do you get a good wife? You deserve a good wife. So you become the kind of person that a good wife would be with. If you're a drunken drug addict idiot, guess who's going to want to be with you? Other drunken drug addict idiots. So don't be that. Same in business. If you're an honest person, if you work hard, if you're relatively intelligent and you're serving your clients well, you will succeed. You'll do well.
Can you tell me about what your working habits look like? I'm just curious about how you work day to day and week to week.
It's just changed over time. I'm an early riser, so I get up early. I have to get a workout in the morning. I'm a Catholic. I go to daily mass, so like I go to church every day. So I got to get my spiritual in line, prayer life in line, my physical life in line first, and then I will do deep work. So I typically do not have any meetings in the morning, and I'm doing deep work. That means I don't have a cell phone. I don't own a cell phone. I don't put on the internet if I can avoid it. I go to the library and I take a pen and a piece of paper and I'm just thinking for 3 or 4 hours in the morning. Then in the afternoon, I'm having the meetings and doing the administrative work that's necessary for the business. And then I end every day at 5 o'clock and I'm done. No, it's 9 to 5. That's it. If I can't make it work, and then in that time frame, you know, I'm too old to like burn the midnight hour, because there's more to life than business. Business is a part of life. There's this great line, and there's this amazing monastery that creates this beautiful beer in Belgium where I was at. He's got this super famous beer production, and they're interviewing him. And they're like, so tell us, like, and he stopped the interviewer and he says, we don't live to brew beer. We brew beer to live. So business is a means to an end. I love it. I like to do it. It's great. I'm blessed that I'm able to do it. I think it serves people, but it's not my whole life. So it ends at 5. It's not my whole life.
Is there anything else from the business perspective that you want to share? And maybe the perspective would be like something that you would want to tell to yourself at the beginning of Growth Era, some information that would have empowered you.
I would say what kept me from succeeding in business before this, it was very late to have any success, and is I wanted to do everything myself. You need other people. So the minute I found somebody else who was complementary to my skill set, Darko, my co-founder, I would run my mouth all the time, and guess what would get done, Dan? Nothing would get done, because my mouth would run and I'd feel good about running my mouth and everybody, like whatever, sitting around the table. And Darko would sit around and we had this great trade. I knew what to do because I was old. He was young and had a lot of energy and just did stuff. So I would run my mouth. He would go off and do the stuff. And I was like, wow, this is kind of like a miracle. I'm actually running my mouth and he's doing what I'm saying to do and stuff is happening. Whereas before, I would just run my mouth and go to sleep and wake up the next day and run my mouth some more and nothing would happen. And then bringing in other people, as hard as other people are to deal with, and they can, we've had people steal our business model. We've had people stiff us for money. It's been a nightmare sometimes with humans. But then there's these other people that you can bring in and they just crush it. So building a team of other people to collaborate with, to me, was the biggest change. And so if you're there trying to grind alone because you think you're saving money, trust me, better find other people to collaborate with somehow.
Let's talk about your time abroad and the concept of nomading versus living a more traditional life. I'm curious if you could share some thoughts. Maybe give us some background on what your nomad career was like.
Yeah. I read the 4-Hour Work Week when I was abroad. So I was already living in Spain for a couple of years. And came back to the States for a little while. And I would say overall, I did the nomadic quote unquote thing. Oh, they weren't calling it that in 2008. It was just like being an expat or whatever for about 13 years. And my impression of the lifestyle, let's say, changed over time. So in the beginning, I sort of felt like I had solved the problems in my life. I had a divorce in 2006 and I didn't know what to do with my life. I felt like, okay, I'm going to play 52 pickup with my life. I'm going to throw the cards up and see how, because I didn't know what to do, just kind of despondent and lost. And so it seemed like a great solution. I just bought a one-way ticket to Frankfurt and 10 years later, I was still abroad. And it seemed in the beginning like a massive solution to my problem. I was getting all these stamps on my passport and all of that. And then I think over time, as I look back, it was important. It was great to see. It was really beautiful to see these different places in the world. But over time, it's kind of like, I think of a lot about nutrition because I've had some health problems as you get older. Sometimes, guys, this happens. And I was kind of frustrated with what the Western medicine was able to provide for me, like medicines. And I just wasn't getting that much relief from it. So I started to dive into nutrition. With nutrition, what you learn very quickly is that your body needs certain things in order to thrive. And if it's not getting those things, you're going to, over time, suffer. But in the short term, you can eat crap and you can get by on crap. You can eat a donut and the donut will fill your body. It will give you calories. You will get energy from it. But if you're eating a bunch of stuff that you shouldn't eat over time, it's going to tell. And there were some essential nutrients in my life that I was missing. And I thought that the lifestyle, quote unquote, was hurting my ability to have those nutrients in my life.
What are they?
So I would say the first one is community. Obviously, all of our goals is to live a happy life. We want to flourish as a human being, as the kind of thing that we are. So what kind of thing are we, right? Because same thing with nutrition. Your body has a certain need for nutrition because it's a kind of thing. It has a certain nature. And we have a certain nature as human beings. According to Aristotle, who's my favorite philosopher, we're social animals. So how do I prove that to you? Well, you speak language and you learned language really easily as a child. And the reason is because it's in your nature, and language is unintelligible if it weren't for this, your social being as your nature.
Like you can't communicate to nature with your language.
Right. Like you're a social animal. You need other people in order to flourish as a human being. And so for me, I really struggled to find deep community in my life as I was abroad traveling around to all these different places. And what are the deepest communities? I thought that the lifestyle ultimately was a move against the two primal communities in the world, like family. Like I don't have a kid. I don't have a wife. I didn't choose that. And I look back now and I don't think that was a great call, actually, because that's the primary relationship of a human life is a family. I'm back now with my father. I don't have children myself. I'm divorced. My father's got the beginnings of Parkinson's, right? So I can't play golf with my dad. So now I'm like weighing up all those great nights in Bali over the last decade when he didn't have Parkinson's and weighing that against more weekend golf trips with dad. And as I do the math on that in my deep work sessions at the library when I'm therapizing myself, I'm like, hey, that wasn't a great call. Maybe hanging out with dad over the time was more in line with your nature or what you should have been doing. Number two, so I had struggled to build real communities. Also because I'm traveling around so much, it led to, let's say, the accentuation of some of the darker sides of my nature. Because part of what community does is it builds in accountability. Because people know you in your small town. And so if you're showing up drunk, naked every night at the whatever, like people in Lancaster are pointing the finger at you like, hey, dude, you don't got to get on a buggy, bro. But like, maybe you should like put on some pants at the middle, you know, when you come home after your bottle of vodka at the middle of the night. Right. So,
yeah.
But if you're a rando walking around Bangkok in the middle of the evening, let's just say that if you're a guy like me, a sinner, you can find your way into some problematic endeavors. And I did. Also, it enabled, because I didn't have as deep relationships with people, because I didn't know them, because I was traveling around so much, it enabled me to use them more rather than love them. And I think we should love people, not use them, because I didn't know them. So it was easier to do that, try to be with women and commit as little as possible to get what I wanted at that particular time. And I got involved in relationships that were based upon that. And I'm not super proud of that. I don't think it was a good use of my time. I think it was a bad decision. And I don't blame fully the lifestyle, but it certainly aided in pushing me in that direction. Because again, I was divorced from any kind of real community. I'm some random dude walking down a street in Bangkok. Who cares what I do? That was part of the quote unquote freedom that I was pursuing. And also the third thing, I was so into optionality, keeping my options open and just switching all the time. And when you inculcate this mentality of switching, you end up hurting what you need most, which is deep relationships with human beings, which require that you're with them, even when it's not fun. Because Aristotle would say there's three different levels of friendship. You have the friendship of entertainment. Hey, Dan, when it's fun to hang out, we hang out. But if you get cancer, bro, and you can't go to the club, I'm not sure we're going to hang out anymore because that's not as much fun when you get, you know, if you get cancer, God forbid. Or like the second level would be friendships of utility. Hey, man, let's do a deal together, bro. Let's build an app. I love you, but if our business falls apart, that's it. The highest level is a friendship of virtue. Your children, the child that Ian has, for example, your partner, is that in a way, according to Aristotle, would be a friendship of virtue. That child brings the best out of Ian. He forces Ian to be a better person, to serve the child. Ian has to subordinate his egotistical desires in order to serve his child. So that's like a really high level. That's becoming perfected as the kind of thing that you are as a human being. So we're social animals and we're rational animals. So we want to know what's true. Locally here in Philly, we have a place called Kensington where everybody shoots heroin openly out in the street. And I guess if we think that freedom is just doing whatever you want, they're the freest people in the world because they're just doing whatever they want, including shooting heroin in their veins. And I just came to learn freedom. I have this quote about freedom, which I wanted to say. It's like, freedom is the disciplining of desire so as to make the achievement of the good first possible, then effortless. And I just didn't have a good version of what my life should be about. And so I just got addicted to a lot of things that were lower than what it could have been. And over time, that led me to a lot of sorrow, and I hurt a lot of people, and I did a lot of shameful things. And I don't blame the lifestyle 100%. That's me. That's my own wayward nature. But I combined that wayward nature with a certain, let's say, lifestyle, and it ended up bringing me to my knees, of bringing me to a place of real lack and of real depravity and of real darkness. So in the long run, it turned out great, because then, you know, I asked for help from a power greater than myself, and I was able to find that. You want a real life. And I think a real life is a real community that you meet with in real time, locally, not mediated by a screen. It's having people that you're willing to sacrifice for, to love, to die for even. And if you don't have that, in a certain way, you haven't really grown up, or at least I didn't.
That's wonderful. I love that. I want to point out my Aristotle nerdery extends as far as yours does. And I notice that you say flourishing a lot, which is an Aristotle thing. And it tries to capture more than happiness and pleasure. He's trying to look for something deeper. I always thought that friendship passage in the Ethics is one of the most beautiful you ever wrote.
Yeah.
Maybe something we can share, I can read on the pod or something.
So the definition of freedom, I think we get wrong, which is we think it's negative freedom, like freedom from constraint. And that's not true. Freedom from constraint is what you get in Kensington. I'm allowed to buy cigarettes. I can go buy them because I'm over 18, but I'm not free because I can't stop smoking them. So that's not freedom. And then happiness we get wrong, because we think modern people think that happiness is about subjective well-being. But real goodness, from the older view, the scholastic view, is that it's indistinguishable from goodness. So what Aristotle would say is eudaimonia is a pursuit of virtue amongst friends, in a community of friends. So you have to find out what's good, and you have to live for what is good, and discipline yourself to do that. Do good, avoid evil, live your life that way. And that's living your life for love. Or St. Thomas Aquinas, who's the, you know, medieval translator of Aristotle, essentially would say, to love is to will the good of the other. So you don't treat other people as things to use, but as ends in themselves, that you can love and you can serve. And if you do that, you'll be successful in your life. And that's a good thing. And that's true happiness. That's true flourishing as the kind of thing that you are, as a social animal, as a rational animal. That's what you're really looking for. That's the true nutrition that your body needs. But what I would say is that being a good person and serving others and living your life in love, that's what this is about. And if you do that, you'll be fine. You'll do fine in business. You'll be like the Amish. You'll have a higher probability of doing well.
I think that with these things, they're extremely powerful, you know, like unmooring yourself from a community. We talk a lot about the positives of that, because there can be, like you mentioned, there's a lot of positives to unmooring and exploration, but it's such a powerful thing that it can throw you over the side too, if you don't recognize that power. Also like to point out an author that you mentioned, St. Thomas Aquinas, is really relevant, I think, as both a role model and as a thinker, and someone I've spent some time with too. So I would underline that.
If anybody's interested, I also have a podcast kind of ministry that I have called firstfishermanmedia.com. And we do different podcasts. We do a podcast from Kensington where we go down and we video different people that run soup kitchens down there. And we interviewed a guy who's a blind man, and he takes in gang members in order to help them reform their lives. And really inspiring stories through that darkness of what's going on down there. So if anybody wants to nerd out on philosophy, reach out to me. I'm happy to do it. I love it. I'm super into it.
I love it, Andrew. Thank you. I appreciate it. And I think it's super relevant, because there's a spiritual element to so much of spiritual and religious element behind so many of the things that we talk about on the show. So I think it's very relevant to hear how individuals have, what sort of conclusions people have reached. So I think it's really interesting to hear your story.
Amen. Thank you so much, Dan. I really appreciate it. And really appreciate the work that you do. And I'm glad hopefully somebody got some value.
Andrew Jacoby, thanks for joining us on the TMBA pod.
Thanks so much.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Tropical MBA podcast. You can go to tropicalmba.com, get access to hundreds of back episodes and all kinds of other goodies. Load up your iPod. That is the cheapest way to fly business class on your next international flight. We will see you next Thursday morning 8 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.